Thank you, Dr. Ford. So this is, when we envision this panel, we envision this as an opportunity to have a conversation with you about some of these issues as we grapple with them and try to determine what race and racism mean in the context of racial of vaccine disparities. So I'm going to share with you some work that we did in 2009-2010 where we are looking at those issues, but I'm also going to share with you some questions we have about, you know, exactly how we did that and how do we interpret what we found. So this is the research team. And I'm going to start with talking about some of our findings on disparities in exposure, susceptibility, and access to care. Then trust. And then the acceptance of emergency drugs and vaccines in a public health emergency. And then some questions and future directions. So in 2009, you may remember that we had a declared pandemic in June of 2009. And early on in that pandemic, as I read news stories and watched the evening news, I began to see these reports that there were, in fact, disparities early on in the pandemic and who was getting severely ill. And it was largely African Americans and Latinos. So there was early on a disproportionate impact seen. So we got funding from the Centers for Disease Control and we carried out two national surveys. So on one side, you see that our first survey was in June, just after the pandemic was declared, with 1,543 respondents, and we oversampled African Americans and Latinos. Then we did a second period of data collection in January of 2010, about 6 months later, over 2,000 respondents, and 913 of those respondents were a longitudinal sample at wave one and wave two. I'm going to focus my talk more on what we found with regard to African Americans today. We use Knowledge Network's online panel, which is developed through random digit dial and address-based probability sampling, so it is representative of the U.S. We also, the way Knowledge Networks works is that to ensure that they have representation across all income levels, they provide the equipment and internet access to those who did not have it, and it was translated into Spanish for Latino participants. We had a whole array of variables associated with perceptions of flu, perceptions of vaccination, also race was self-identified, how did people self-identify their race and their ethnicity. We asked about discrimination in healthcare and a whole array of other things, and I'll talk about a few of them today. So, as I said, we began to see disparities early in the pandemic. And we had read, my team and I had read an article by Blumenschein and colleagues that presented a conceptual model of disparities in the case of a pandemic. And what they proposed was that differences in social position based on income or occupation or race and ethnicity would create disparities at three different sort of in three different ways. One was disparities in exposure to flu virus, disparities in susceptibility to contracting the disease and to complications, and disparities in treatment if you got the disease. And what they speculated is these three things combined together would yield disproportionate impacts in morbidity and mortality. So we proposed the first empirical test, and I think at this point the only empirical test. So we had to create the measures to capture what these disparities may look like. So we had structural measures, and one of the things that Drs. Ford and Aramburu talk about is looking at structural determinants of health. So do you live in an apartment? Do you live in an urban area? How many children are in the household? We had a number of structural measures. We also looked at one of the things that was being talked about then was being able to stay home from work or social distance. So we looked at do you have sick leave? Can your work be done at home? Can you stay out of the workplace? We also looked at what we know are important factors is can you avoid other ways that you come in contact with the larger public by avoiding public transportation or having daycare apart from other children, private daycare. We measured susceptibility through a self-reported chronic disease or immune suppression. And we measured access to care by asking about insurance coverage, whether somebody had a regular provider, whether they had ever experienced discrimination in health care, and whether they had a perceived financial burden of getting the vaccine. So I'm going to focus here on our results related to African Americans in particular. But what we did find was that African Americans, and along with Spanish-speaking and English-speaking Hispanics, were at greater risk of exposure due to their geographic and living situation. The whole theme here of the conference is healthography, so how place matters, and we found that to be the case. For African Americans, the other place where we found a disproportionate risk of exposure was in difficulty having private daycare for your children and difficulty avoiding public transportation. In essence, do you have a car or do you have to rely on public transportation? African Americans had a marginally higher risk associated with susceptibility based on their reporting of chronic diseases, and also reported discrimination when receiving health care. So we saw disparities across these three things, exposure, susceptibility, and access to care, that could lead to greater disease burden. So remember I said we had a longitudinal sample of 903 people. And so this reports on what we found when we looked at those disparities in June at wave one, and then we asked them, have you had influenza-like illness since the start of the pandemic in April, which is when it really began? And what we found was that there was a higher incidence of influenza-like illness was associated with greater inability to social distance at work and a greater number of children in the home. Latinos were particularly hit hard, but when we looked overall at the whole sample, what we found when we looked at absence of policies that would enable people to have sick leave and avoid the workplace and social distance led to a population attributable risk of 5 million additional flu cases. And Latinos in particular were hit hard here. So this, we believe, was really the first case where it was the first empirical test, but it actually predicted disease incidence. And so African Americans were already at risk based on exposure, susceptibility, and access to care. So that made understanding whether people got the vaccine when the vaccine was available even more important. So we were also in the literature, there's a lot of discussion about trust in government and whether this makes a difference in terms of vaccine acceptance. So we ask about this, trust in government actions during the pandemic, not trust in government writ large. But historically, all the data would show that African Americans have lower rates of trust in government, and not surprisingly, given the racialized context in which we live. So there is a model called the Trust Determination Model, and again, there were not empirical measures, so we had to create those empirical measures. And basically, they look at issues in the model as commitment, caring, concern, openness, competence. And we asked, How committed do you think the federal government is to protecting you? How much care and concern do you think the government has shown? How open do you think they've been in communication? How competent? How honest has the government been with information regarding the flu? And remember, it was called swine flu earlier. And then there was some qualitative work by Lisa Meredith and her colleagues that looked at African Americans' concerns during a bioterrorist event, and they found this issue of what they termed fiduciary responsibility. How much do you believe the government's actions are in your personal best interest? So we created an item on that. So we looked at these items, and here's what we found. So remember I said that historically, trust in government is lower. We found that African Americans actually had the highest level of trust in government actions, and higher than whites, at both wave one and wave two, and in fact it went up from wave one in June to wave two in January the following year. Not surprisingly, in this context, healthcare workers were the most trusted source, but also African Americans had high levels of trust, and it stayed high over time in local health officials and in CDC, not local elected officials who often speak during an emergency like a pandemic. You know, those elements, commitment, caring, openness, honesty I spoke about, African Americans had higher levels of agreement saying that they thought the government had been caring and concerned, was working in their best interest, both at wave one and wave two, and that went up from wave one and wave two. And then we said, okay, if we looked at the overall trust, does that make a difference in taking the H1N1 vaccine, which became available in October of 2009? And it did predict. It was one of the predictors of vaccine acceptance. But we also found that the quality of communication, and so we asked about whether communication was clear, whether it was consistent, whether people understood that communication would change over time, as it always does in an unfolding pandemic or an emergency. And we found that quality of communication really was highly associated with higher trust levels. So what was the difference in 2009 and 2010 that led to seeing these higher levels of trust? Well, if we think back, in January of 2009, President Obama was inaugurated. A year later, he'd been in office for a year. So there had been, certainly in many people's minds, a major change in government. And so we speculated that that may be what we were seeing here, is that we're really talking about a government with the first black president at its head. So also in 2009, when the pandemic was declared, there was real concern that there would not be time to produce an H1N1 vaccine, and particularly one that had time to be produced and go through the routine process that all flu vaccines go through for testing. So there was conversation in the summer, the spring and the summer of 2009, that there may need to be what was called an emergency use authorization of a vaccine or a drug. What is an emergency use authorization? Many of you probably never heard that term. What it is that in the time of a public health emergency, which would be declared by the Secretary of Health and Human Services in partnership with the Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Commissioner at FDA, drugs could be approved for use that either had never been approved before, might be in early clinical trials, or had been approved for a different use and now was being approved for what's called off-label use, for use other than its initial approved use. So in summer of 2000, and 9, we were thinking that we might have one of these EUA vaccines. So imagine I'm coming to you and saying, would you take a drug that has not gone through the normal approval processes? How many of you would take that vaccine? Don't overwhelm me here, folks. Okay. Maybe there's one sort of tentative hand there. Okay. Well, what did we see? And we ask about this at wave 1, and then we ask about this at wave 2. So at wave 1, what we found is 60% of African Americans said, absolutely not. We would not take this vaccine. Yet, they had higher level of trust in government actions. They also had the highest level of worry about such a vaccine. Okay? And we found that being African American, and particularly with lower income and lower education, meant more people were likely to be undecided. But what we know from the vaccine literature is that if you're undecided, you're likely to put off getting the vaccine or never get the vaccine. So being then therefore at higher risk potentially of getting the disease and those disparities we talked about. So now I'm going to switch gears to a drug for treatment. So in October 2009, there was an authorization of Paramivir. Paramivir was in early clinical trials, okay, in adults, never tested in children at all. It was approved for use in adults and children. So I'm going to share with you the data about adults here, not the children. Now, when an emergency use authorized drug is given, there is a fact sheet that is shared. And the fact sheet, this is literally the text from the fact sheet. I did not make this up. Paramivir is experimental because it is still being studied. It is not approved by FDA for use in the United States. There's limited information known about the safety and effectiveness of using Paramivir. So this is what you get when you're offered Paramivir. And so we looked at whether people would accept Paramivir if they were severely ill, if they were in the hospital, if their doctor recommended, if they had no alternatives. And I'm just going to present the data with African Americans here. So what were some of the factors associated with refusal to take the drug? The term experimental decreased willingness to take the drug, no matter across those four conditions, no matter if there was no alternative. Needing more information decreased willingness. And you saw that in the fact sheet said there's limited information, right? Being middle-aged, we're less likely to take Paramivir than younger African-American participants. So what made a difference? People who were middle-income were more likely to take the drug than lower-income. People who had regular health care providers were more likely. But also across all the conditions, trusting the FDA and trusting government action were more likely to take the drug, even if they needed more information. So suddenly, you know, what does this mean for us who are concerned about communication on these kinds of issues? Trust is important, but it's not sufficient. The quality of communication, as I said, makes a difference. But remember, in the context of an EUA drug or vaccine, we don't have a lot of information. And so that information is going to change. And so that's always going to be a challenge. So a couple of thoughts. What were we really measuring? We're doing this analysis based on people saying, I'm African American or I'm Latino. And so we think we were also measuring some of the intersectionality of race and other factors like income or education. We were clearly talking about or I think measuring some of people's encounters with racism, that fear of the term experimental, and contemporary racial relations. Here we had a black president, and it seemed to really make a difference, but it wasn't enough by itself. So now, as you're going to hear from our qualitative work and our current study in a little bit, but now as we think about going back into the field in January of this coming year, we're really grappling with how do we explore that race, that impact of racism in vaccine decision making, and how might racial identity, if at all, affect vaccine decision making. So these are open questions, and we're grappling with it. So I want to acknowledge my collaborators, including Dr. Kim, who we lost this year, and my funders, CDC, funded the survey research, and NIMHD, our current research. Thank you.